Namaste and welcome to the Bharat Vartha Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyapa. I have my fellow panelists, Prasanna Vishwanathan and Nirav Kanodra, to take you through the news and events of the week that was. Well, it was an action-packed week, of course. Festival season here in India. So we had Deepavali celebrations and we're going to talk about some of the aspects associated with that, including the fact that there was 1.25 trillion rupees worth of business that was generated. The Prime Minister unveiled the Shankaracharya statue at Kedarnath. Then we had the COP26, the climate conference that we earlier discussed as well, that happened last week. There was some interesting news about Mukesh Ambani relocating to London, right? And of course, you know, the big news, the big positive news from last week was Covaxin being approved by WHO, which is again a landmark thing. And we also had oil prices being cut in various states, right? So, all right, so plenty of news to cover on this weekly. And as usual, we'll get started with looking back at the episode we put out last week. So we spoke to Ashley Rinsberg, who's just written a book called The Grey Lady Winked. And this was a fascinating conversation. You know, all of us are surprised sometimes, you know, to see the kind of headlines and reportage that is there about India in the foreign press. Here, Ashley has gone back 100-150 years to really look at the history of, you know, some of this stuff, right? And he talks about how the New York Times covered World War II, for example, where they said Poland actually invaded Germany, right? And Germany was defending. How they covered up the Ukraine famine and plenty of other things. So, Nirav, what do you think about this episode?
Oh, yeah. So, a couple of like very interesting things. That first was that the Sullenberger family, which owns the New York Times, is like very much, as like most newspapers tend to be, that they're focused about their revenues. At the time of World War II, actually, it was a Jewish family which have like slowly intermarried and like they're no longer practicing Jewish people. But they covered it because they were thinking that they'll get more revenue from Berlin, from the international editions. So they've kept their business interests first. Also, the second part where he says that with the advent of online media, you only few paying subscribers who pay for the subscription, whereas the readers are much wider compared to the traditional print media. So what happens is they are speaking more to their audience, which is more hard left, and they are catering to that part. So it's when they are talking about, say, even India, they are reinforcing biases that their existing readers have, and they are portraying news what they want to see, rather than being objective media portraying the news as what it is. So it's very interesting. The whole episode is worth listening to. Please, if you missed it, do give it a listen.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a very, very interesting episode. Also, do check out the couple of episodes we recorded with Richard Sharma and Vishal Ganeshan on a related topic itself. So last week was Deepavali, and you know, after a year of rather somber, very mellow circumstance, I mean, we had Deepavali, and you know, revelers thronged the markets for festival purchases this year, helping generate business worth rupees 1.25 trillion. And according to the Confederation of All India Traders (CAIT), this trade figure broke the past 10 years' sales record on Diwali. They added that this time no Chinese goods were sold, and customers emphasized buying made in India goods. Due to this buying trend, China has suffered a loss of business amounting to over 50,000 crores. In the same vein, the toll collection through FASTag recorded an all-time high of 214.23 million transactions, which is about 21.42 crores in October. And the all-time high collections indicates the economic and transport-related activities in the country are improving significantly, particularly during the festive season. So, Prasanna, I think we're seeing the recovery in full form right now. What do you think?
Yeah, I think a lot of good economic data all around, you know, from GST collections to, as you just pointed out, FASTag, which is, I think, a good enough indication that mobility, especially in the highways, has returned almost to the pre-pandemic level, which also, I think, explains the confidence that NHAI also floated its InvIT. So basically 8,000 crore InvIT, where it's going to monetize some of its road assets in few key states. So I think one of the reasons why it was delayed, it was supposed to be launched possibly sometime last year, but you know, the traffic in the Indian highways and expressways were a little muted, and so they couldn't really have the confidence to go ahead with that. So all around, I think very, very good economic data. I think, like, unless there is this possibility of third wave happening, I think we are on a course to a very, very strong recovery. And as you just pointed out, the retail numbers during the Diwali season have been pretty phenomenal, you know, almost like 70%, 1.25 lakh crores. And I think this is the number given by the trader organization, right? That's so they tend to be like highly skeptical and pessimistic. If you really look at their previous, you know, public pronouncements, typically they've always been, you know, largely reflecting the struggles of the main street or the retail, the conventional retail. So now that they say it's been a fantastic blockbuster retail sales, and even if you account for the inflation, still, you know, 70%+ growth is some, you could put it to maybe revenge spending, everything, but still, I think it's broadly reflective of the sentiments of the Indian public. The gloom and doom proponents are still around. Of course, structural challenges continue to remain, and the possibility of another wave. This is like a pandemic which we've not fully understood, right? I mean, when could there be a resurgence and all that? But if that situation doesn't unfold, very good numbers. And also, I think the festival sales by all the online retailers, right, which was probably in the first week of October, that was almost like 30 to 35,000 crores, which was again a 20-25% jump over the last year's sales. And I think, like, India's on course for a 1 trillion, 1 lakh crore online retail sales by, like, say, 2024-25. Overall, very, very heartening that the consumer sentiment is return back, and government finances are in good shape. So you could, I mean, I think we might be discussing it a little later, that I mean, I think the government is kind of being little smart by you know, capturing the revenue through the you know, the exercise, and now when they have fiscal room, they've kind of, you know, reduced it, which could also prove to be a sentiment booster in the next couple of months. So all around, I think we are in a nice spot. God willing, going from strength to strength from here. I think the second quarter GDP number should be out in the last Friday of, I think it should be October and November, November and December end, we should get the numbers. So I think this should be, I think we should be surprised to the positive, probably even 10% plus. RBI and others, I think the other analysts have all projected around 9. I wouldn't be surprised if we reach the 10% quarterly growth in this second quarter. So fingers crossed, huh? Hope all turns out well.
Yeah, absolutely. Nirav, what do you think?
No, so I think basically Diwali is like a victory of like light over dark. I think for a year and a half, you have had like, most people have been like in a mini vanvas, that you are like hiding inside your own house. You couldn't spend. So a lot of it is also, say, as Prasanna pointed, like revenge spending. But it's a good thing. This raises animal spirits. India probably has got herd immunity via vaccination plus infection. The second wave was very brutal. A lot of like people who lost near and dear ones, for them, it was like a little bit muted, sad Diwali celebration. But this is a good thing. I think this is pushes India into a virtuous cycle, because someone spending is somebody else's income, the trader's income. And this kickstarts the reopening and growth of the economy. So it's a very heartening and a positive sign.
Yeah, no, it was so pleasant to see families out there shopping, right? I mean, so I hope this continues. And on a related note, Delhi's air quality took a dive, right? the national capital witnessed a major spike in pollution levels on the eve of Diwali, as the air quality inched towards the severe mark, with scores of people flouting the firecracker ban and, I suppose, the seasonal stubble burning as well. The situation, as I mentioned, was exacerbated by the seasonal farm fires, with the share of stubble burning in Delhi's pollution rising to 25% on the morning of Diwali. It is expected to rise further in the coming days. People from several parts of the city and its suburbs complained of itchy throat and watery eyes as a layer of smog. The first episode this season enveloped the environment. Nirav, pretty unfortunate, right?
So why is it unfortunate? See, one is people say that, oh, you should have a firecracker ban. But that is putting a band-aid over like a deep wound, right? Like it is. So I think that we need to realize it first. And you can also have control studies where there is no firecracker burning a week before Diwali. What was the air quality index, AQI, with like they have the PM 2.5 levels like 450, etc. versus what it is. We've had like very good satellite imagery and geothermal mapping of like the heat generated that you can tell like where the fires are. I think this problem needs to be solved in like a maybe non-conventional manner. For example, I like this, the Coase theorem in economics, where you say that if Delhi citizens are feeling a discomfort due to stubble burning in Punjab, maybe Delhi taxpayers or the Delhi government should be able to say that, okay, we pay farmers of Punjab either not to grow paddy, which I think is probably the right thing, maybe grow some other corn or something else, not to burn the stubble, maybe use harvesters or lease harvesters during the season, collect that and maybe controlled burning in a power plant or like mix it with something else or have cardboard factories. So I think it needs an unconventional solution. I think gimmicks like odd even or gimmicks like stubble burning, firecracker ban is just kind of papering over the cracks, right? So I think like a more serious solution is required. And we need to think a little bit out of the box that we cannot have continue to do the same things over and over again and expect different results. So I think Einstein said that insanity is doing the same thing repeatedly, expecting different results. And I think that's where we've led to. Hopefully we move ahead from this and find a proper solution.
What do you think about, you know, the whole civil disobedience in some sense, right? I mean, people flouting the cracker ban and...
Okay, so I think... See, firecrackers, one is it gives a lot of joy. I myself, even in Singapore, I burst some in a controlled environment where permissions were there. So that is one thing. In Diwali, it's a nice tradition, all of that. At the margin, it provides very little additional pollution. So I think that needs to be taken care of. Like, I think that is the first thing. Even our courts have been like overstepping their boundaries and like commenting on things which are not exactly legal or like constitutional in matter. So here we need to be able to give with data that how much additional pollution was there in, like, say, other cities where firecrackers were burst, and how much is it in Delhi, and how much is it due to stubble burning. And if you do that, yes, there was some sort of civil disobedience. I think these kind of things probably are taking the debate in the wrong direction. I hope something happens. China had seen Beijing with worse air quality improve, and there they took some decisions after the Beijing Olympics. Hopefully, India also kind of pulls its socks up and does the same here.
Yeah, I mean, just that we need to be, in the interest of fairness, point out China, in fact, I was quite surprised. China, in fact, had banned firecrackers during the Chinese New Year in some 44 cities, which are typically, you know, 2 million, 3 million plus. I think you know, the as Nirav said, I mean, I don't think so there was major civil disobedient movement or something like that. You know, of course the way in which the you know, ham-handed way in which this entire pollution debate has been conducted, and you know, it's almost it's quite unfortunate that it has become a culture and tradition versus environment debate. It should have never degenerated to this kind of a debate. And it's a very Delhi-centric problem. Let's be very honest about it. And almost, you know, because of the judicial encroachment, and you know, the it's see, this is like very interesting because in India, right, you have a you have institutional checks and balances where there is always a judiciary versus executive confrontation. So each of these institutions try to assert themselves and then retreat. So it's a constant state of flux that is happening. But I think this pollution is one issue where I think the judiciary can kind of exercise an upper hand, so as to speak, without any pushback from the executive, because environment being that kind of issue, and especially in the context of Delhi centricity of all our rulers, you know, I think judiciary is kind of really found an issue where it can go full blast, and government is not able to really respond in a very clever and intelligent way. You know, this just started in very well-connected, powerful Supreme Court lawyer. I think he's probably a South Indian by name. He kind of filed a case, and then it took a life of its own. And then, you know, the judiciary intervened, and then what started as a Delhi problem then became an NCR problem. Then it became almost like a pan-Indian issue, you know. So the scope creep has been tremendous. In fact, the Bangalore numbers during Diwali days were like quite good. The air quality was quite good despite having literally a blast during Diwali. So I think this has to be handled with a very Delhi-centric approach. And also, you know, I kind of really identify and empathize with people who, you know, think that there is a selective shaming of Hindu festivals, and, you know, this kind of heightened environmental activism is typically linked, you know, to, you know, focusing on a particular Hindu tradition, which I absolutely agree. But I also do think that during the day of Diwali, Delhi does, I think the firecracker burst dust exacerbates an existing pollution problem in Delhi for one day. But you know, you have much more clever solution. I think the debate, unfortunately, the debate itself was not started. You know, maybe a community fireworks organized by the government, and I think the green crackers are slowly scaling up. In fact, almost all the crackers that were sold in Bangalore, I found, were quote unquote certified as the green crackers. So whatever that means, though. I think somewhere technology, common sense, better policy making, you know, and also this competitive outraging and casting this debate as environment versus religion. I think all this, everybody needs to step back a bit and take a much more informed perspective. That's my sense of this debate.
Yeah. No, and I think the bans also tend to have the opposite effect, because I know even anecdotally that people who had given up bursting crackers have almost gone out and bought, you know, crackers just as a way to support, you know, the tradition and stuff. And I think the broader point is that, you know, all the laws and the...
I think the police also realize that it's kind of enforceable. Unenforceable.
Yeah, exactly.
Once, you know, people start to desire crackers in large Indian cities where... you know, 20 million people live in Bangalore, or I think probably 30 million people live in the NCR. So there's no question of enforceability. But I think they should be, they're also seen as acting because the judiciary is, I think, kind of really made it like a prestige issue, so as to speak. I've just seen the way in which the courts, they don't seem to be amenable to any reasonable argument. Like, for example, you know, the AG had proposed that let's look at green crackers, let's look at staggered timings and everything. But I think the judiciary has kind of taken itself as the environmental warrior, and almost, you know, I'm sure they are very pretty emasculated when it comes to taking on the farmers of Punjab for stubble burning. So, you know, this is like a very easy target that you could, you know, pile on, and, you know, you could show all your... you know, throw your judicial theories at them, and you know, the supremacy of the judiciary is getting established by going after a very easy target. Actually, that's really what it has come to.
No, and it's pretty silly, because I mean, as you mentioned, right? I mean, we don't have adequate state capacity to solve for even like hard crime, right? And how are you going to go and like arrest people you know, yeah. bursting crackers, right? I think the broader point also is that the law has to reflect the civilizational reality. Otherwise, I mean, it's not
going to... It's a vicious cycle, right? Like, police have to do the optics to please the judiciary, and then you arrest 600 people when you don't have the capacity for solving day-to-day law and order problems. Then, you know, that kind of enrages the common law-abiding citizens or... probably the people for whom, you know, Diwali is very dear to them, and a particular way of celebrating is something that is a very entrenched tradition in the household or whatever, you know. So it's like everybody seemed to be feeding into a cycle which I don't know how it is ever going to be broken. And I think I don't see this having any solution in the next 10 years. Of course, I think Delhi is a rich enough state which can invest in probably it's one city that can quickly adopt EV in public infrastructure. I think, you know, two-wheeler adoption and all. But unfortunately, Delhi is also currently the chief minister who's at the helm of affairs. I think he's trying to break in into Punjab. Okay, so I think he's completely, he's cynical, and he's a very clever and a very cynical person. So he's, I think, like playing both sides of the game. So I don't see any solution in the kind of broken political system that we have. I think eventually when we build infra and electric EVs, and where Delhi kind of addresses its pollution in a much more structural way, probably you could limit the damage, and maybe if Punjab eventually gives up this, very crude cultivation practices and respects environment, and you kind of price in the cost of environment into their agriculture produce, which is not currently happening because we give huge subsidies and all. I think all that has to happen, but I kind of think that it's going to be like a two-decade-old process, where India, it happens, everything happens, but it happens at a slow pace, and it eventually happens. So I think we need to get reconciled to that.
Yeah. No, I think innovation will solve it, more than any bans or regulation.
Absolutely.
So we had some news of, Mr. Mukesh Ambani relocating to London. Recent reports speculated that, Mr. Ambani and his family plan to relocate to London. But they issued the Reliance Industries issued a statement on Friday to put the rumors about this to rest. Earlier this year, Mr. Ambani added the stunning Stoke Park estate in London to his collection for an investment of $79 million. The purchase of heritage property is said to be aimed at enhancing it as a premier golfing and sporting resort. Nirav, I don't know how, but I mean, some of this was misconstrued as capital flight by certain people.
There are a lot of... So one is this property was bought in April. And it is outside London, Buckinghamshire. It's Stoke Park. That's like a country club. It's an old heritage property, which is has a very premier golf course. If James Bond fans remember, that's the course where James Bond plays golf with Goldfinger. It is shot there. So it's a very premier, very expensive golf club. This is a business decision for Mukesh Ambani. I think because there were some renovations and they are adding some hospital, etc., there was some speculation that the family might move there for good. There are also reasons. The other reason has been that you had the whole Sachin Vaze episode, where extortion, a police officer trying to extort 100 crores from the Ambani family, as well as the whole last 1.5 year, where due to COVID, a lot of people couldn't move in and out. Maybe it shows the perception of other Indians who want to say, they want to leave the country, or if they had the money, they want to leave the country. And people have misconstrued this fact. Second thing is, even if they spend time, the family spends time between, say, UK and India, or like anywhere else in India, whatever it is, all their business interests are, most of them are within India, right? For Reliance Industries, the petrochemical business, the telecom business, they don't operate telecom or they don't operate refineries in other countries. So capital flight would be if they were to sell some of their assets here and buy something else, or like buy another company somewhere else, or move their capital out. It is not capital flight. This was purchased for $79 or $80 million for a person who is almost worth $100 billion, right? So it is like small change for somebody like Mukesh Ambani running Reliance Industries. It is a luxury property. It is a business decision aimed at high-end hospitality. So I think that's a business decision. People have overseas homes for vacation homes and he can afford it. So it's not a big deal. A lot has been, I think all the people making these comments is they are reading into things what they want to read, right? It is, they have their bias, they have their preconceived notions. So that is why they want to portray that in everything. I just think it's a business decision. I don't know whether it is good or bad, whether they've overpaid for it, or but it's an iconic property. I know there would be a lot of rich people or luxury tourism who want to go there. And if you're a James Bond fan, you might want to play golf there as well. So, yeah.
No, actually, Roshan, what is a little surprising is that the outrage that he's moving out of India is from the same set of people. I mean, almost there's a good intersection who day in and day out demonize Ambani, Adani as epitomizing the evils of Indian capitalism, and suddenly, you know, assume that like even he had decided to go there for whatever personal reasons, health reasons. And let's be honest that, you know, Mumbai's appalling quality of life, you know, like among all big cities that I've been, I think like, I mean, it would be okay if really he thinks London offers a better quality of life than Mumbai. I mean, you wouldn't be, you can't really blame. So even if you assume all this is true, you know, the sheer hypocrisy that, you know, one hand you, you know, demonize big business, and especially Ambani has been unwittingly a target of relentless vilification. And the same set of people seem to be feeling very depressed and sad that, you know, he's leaving India. So it's I mean, that's what like Nirav said, people want to read what they want to read. And basically the entire narrative is to kind of show that, you know, the as I said, you know, there's good news pouring on economic data and all the profits of doom and gloom. You know, they just want to look at any possible, even if it's a fake narrative, just cling on to it and try to drive some meta point about, you know, how India is like a thing. But honestly, on the larger point, though, reminds that a lot of rich people, I mean, I think it's been happening all the time that they seek a better quality of life abroad. But in Ambani's case, I think, like as Nirav pointed out, his entire business interest is tied to the India's economic success or lack of it. You know, so I mean, even if say for medical reasons or health reasons he wants to relocate there and all. I think there's no flight of capital or something like that in this case, actually. So it's a bogus controversy fueled by, you know, the typical suspects in the media. And, you know, they had 3 days of people joining in and collective outrage. And then it ended after that statement. I mean,
yeah, I pretty much. All right, moving on. The Prime Minister unveiled a new Shankaracharya statue at Kedarnath. Prime Minister Modi reached the Kedarnath temple in Uttarakhand on Friday morning, where he was welcomed by Chief Minister Pushkar Singh Dhami and a few other dignitaries. The Prime Minister unveiled a 12-foot statue of Adi Shankaracharya, and the reconstruction work was worth over 200 crores at the temple premises. The statue has been made by a Mysore-based sculptor using chlorite schist, a rock known to withstand rain, sunshine, and harsh climate. Adiguru Shankaracharya's Samadhi Sthal was washed away in 2013 during the Kedarnath flash flood tragedy. Prasanna, you saw the statue and we were kind of discussing that beforehand as well. It seems magnificent, right?
Yeah, the statue was great. In fact, we did one of my colleagues, Harsha Bhatt, she did she was possibly the first journalist who kind of did a detailed profile of Arun Raj, the Mysore-based sculptor. Very interesting life. I think he had almost given up his family
profession and started, he pursued his MBA. And then in fact, he was working in the private sector. And then later, after he came back to his traditional family profession. And, you know, it's a very, very fascinating story and a very uplifting story, which we published early last week. So fantastic. And, you know, Uttarakhand, Modi government is with some success, and also there have been challenges. Major infrastructure upgrade being attempted in Uttarakhand, especially the Char Dham. But again, you know, the problem of ecology, environment versus development in a hill state. I think government has faced a lot of challenges in accelerating the project, but I think they've stayed the course. Huge road infrastructure, railway infrastructure getting built. Eventually, I think Uttarakhand will be a, you know, access, once the accessibility issue gets fixed, which I think it is going to happen, if not in the next couple of years, within the decade, with both the road and rail connectivity. I think it's going to be a huge destiny for domestic religious tourism. You know, not that it is not already, but, you know, with all the infrastructure and also, of course, the nature tourism, which is always there. So, you know, Uttarakhand, I think Prime Minister also made the point that Uttarakhand's decade is around the corner with the kind of, you know, infrastructure investments and efforts that have gone into. But I think there are some political challenges as well for, I think there's an election coming up in Uttarakhand. It's a part of the UP Punjab election cycle, right? So I think they should go to the polls in the early part of the next year, 2022. So there are, I think the leadership challenges for BJP government there has been there. I think they changed the, I think he's the current chief minister is the third in this 5-year term. And also, I think there was some issues around the government set up a board essentially to provide amenities and common infrastructure for all the 4 Char Dham temples. So it was basically a government-run board. Of course, it had participation from the royalty, the priest and all that. But somehow, there has been a section of the priesthood which has, you know, said that this is a direct interference and takeover of the religious institutions and all that. So that undercurrent of tension is also playing out in some of these, you know, Char Dhams. So, but I think, like, from an overall perspective, I think Modi's has had a very special chemistry with the state per se. And interestingly, in 2013, after the Uttarakhand floods, he as a Gujarat chief minister had offered to rebuild the temple, and it was refused by the then Congress dispensation. So it kind of, life comes a full circle, as they say. So he now, as a prime minister, able to inaugurate this renovated temple as well as this huge Shankaracharya statue. So it's quite interesting overall. And also, I think one of the good things about this was that a lot of this renovation was also funded by the Jindal Group. I think their contribution has been pretty phenomenal. So, you know, that private rich private individuals entering into you know, philanthropic activities to support dharmic, you know, related stuff is really good news. Actually, we need like a lot of such initiatives as well. That's the perspective.
Yeah, for sure. Hopefully, we can visit sometime. at the COP26 summit, Prime Minister Modi promised that India will achieve net zero emissions by 2070. By 2030. India will ensure 50% of its energy will be sourced from renewable energy sources. India will also reduce its emissions intensity per unit of GDP by less than 45%. India would also install 500 gigawatts of renewable energy by 2030. The Prime Minister added that in the spirit of climate justice, rich developed countries ought to be providing at least $1 trillion in climate finance to assist developing countries and those most vulnerable. So we also had our own Greta moment, right? Vinisha Umashankar, a 14-year-old girl from India, was invited by Prince William to speak at the COP26 climate summit. In her speech, she told the world that her generation is, to quote, angry and frustrated at world leaders who've made empty promises and made a direct call to action to save the planet. Nirav, what do you make of all of this?
So I think, see, first, let's look at the positives. So one is that the Western countries, as per the Paris Accord, had said that they reach net zero by 2050. After that, China has made a commitment that it is going to reach net zero by 2060. India has finally come and said that it is by 2070. So now see why the difference is, because the whole stock of like the increase in CO2 in the atmosphere from like 0.3% to 0.4% has gone because of the emissions by the richer nations. So the total amount that they've polluted is a lot more. Now that what they have done is like a lot of the industries have been outsourced to China, and manufacturing related or like more thermal power plants, etc. are there. So developing countries need to be able to reach that level. So that is one thing. Second is the amount of like finance available to for the transition, move away from coal-fired power plants to maybe renewable power plants or nuclear power plants. And like, so that is also needed, transition from combustion engine vehicles to like electric vehicles. So setting up new manufacturing capacity, etc. Right. So I think it's a very good thing, very sensible decision to which timelines we can stick to. Also, India needs a lot more power. We are already consuming very little power per capita. Correct. So our power generation needs to go up a lot. So we cannot be like the Western nations and immediately stop all coal-fired power plants. We will build a lot more. So we've given a commitment for 35 gigawatts of renewable power. So all these are positive things. In terms of getting children to all these summits, I frankly feel sometimes it's an emotional ploy for marketing purposes. I think even when I was a kid very long ago, a lot of kids are very idealistic. Some of the more articulate kids are brought up on stage and they're asked to speak about these things in an emotional manner, but there needs to be a balance. We can immediately shut down all power plants and live in villages or like be hunter-gatherers, right? But we won't. We do want the conveniences of the modern life. We do want to hold these podcasts and use electronic devices, etc. So then we can't have everything. And there needs to be a transition. It needs to be there. I really think that using kids for emotional tactics or sometimes can backfire as well. So I am not a big proponent of this. Let kids be kids and let them figure out their life and path. And do not make some of these kids as small poster child and celebrities. I think it's quite a wrong thing.
Yeah, I mean, and interestingly, I don't know what will be the number of participants who are eventually physically present at that Glasgow, you know, the so many hanger-ons, activists, you know. I mean, I can understand all the world leaders being there and maybe a small security entourage around them. But I mean, I think there's this entire huge gang of, you know, virtual nobodies, busybodies, you know, hanger-ons, so many of them. And I think like if you kind of, as Nirav said, you know, this is nothing but absolute, emotional blackmail and rhetoric. And unfortunately, you know, because of the decency demands that you don't really, say anything which is hurtful. Though I think like in the previous Trump administration, the Treasury Secretary actually said Greta should go to college and talk about energy economics before dishing out all our transition plans and, green goals and all that. But generally, world leaders tend to be more diplomatic than that. So this is going to be the really challenge. And as far as India, I think India, very pragmatic, you know, 2070 seems like I really don't know whether how much of these are very realistic targets, 2050, 60, 70. But as Nirav said, right, though our aggregate emissions look high just because of the sheer size of the population, India has been polluter possibly for decades while all these affluent Western countries have polluted for centuries, and you know, and it's pretty clear that GDP growth is a function of energy intensity. You know, there's no country in the world which is of any size which has significantly gone without burning energy. You know, so I think what Prime Minister Modi has done is a very pragmatic thing, and of course, you know, we've also walked the talk, so as to speak, at least in terms of the renewable energy. And in fact, two of India's biggest corporate conglomerates are big players in the renewable energy space. Hopefully, I think all the serious talk about the climate finance coming towards the developing countries, I think the West and the multilateral institutions, you know, follow whatever they preach. And I mean, I think some serious money should come to India in terms of, you know, various funding loan for the transition to the you know, the renewable energy. And also, I think India also took a pragmatic approach in terms of the coal issue. I think like there are some 100 odd countries which signed up and said that no coal by 2030 or sometime around that. The three biggest consumers, such as China, US and India, didn't sign up for that because they really know that you know, it's not going to be as simple as completely shutting out the coal crisis. And even as we speak, you know, despite all the demonization of the coal, I think coal prices are almost touched $300 this year. You know, maybe it's moderated now, but it was almost $300. And both India and China to a large extent, and India, eventually when there was an energy crisis, had to lift more coal and fire the power plants and, you know, tide over the energy crisis, right? Like, I don't think so renewable has achieved that critical mass, especially around storage solutions. Though a lot of best and brightest people in the world and good money is chasing grid storage around solar and all that. Hopefully we get some commercially scalable solution. So I think overall India did well in terms of its pragmatic approach, and I don't know, China, I think Xi Jinping even didn't go there.
He was the only one in this great. So COP26 was 26 nations and G20. He's remained in China and joined virtually.
I don't know. Maybe it's something to do with probably the domestic situation in China. I don't think so. He's really moved out anywhere in the last 18 to 24 years. Maybe that's a different discussion. So I think a lot of hot air in this conference, but some pragmatic solutions, especially the realization in terms of what is the kind of financing requirements that is needed to do this kind of a transition. And hopefully, you know, let's see how India follows upon some of its commitments.
I think in either case, I mean, it's a bad idea to have, you know, international commitments at this rate, right? I mean, we should retain the optionality to solve this our own way. And I personally feel that, you know, India will actually take India will actually leap on whether it's EV or sustainability and so on. I think, you know, there's plenty of innovation happening. And if you look at EV, for example, you know, the kind of subsidies that we're offering, the FAME subsidies, and, you know, saying that, you know, public transport buses have to be moved to EV and so on. I think we'll do more than well, but not a good idea to be beholden to, you know, out of country powers on that front.
Right? Correct. So, I mean, you have to charter your own energy independence and also be mindful of, you know, some of the concerns. You know, you can't outright take a be dismissive, like say some of the U.S. Republicans tend to be on this entire climate crisis. You know, I mean, even if there has been an exaggerated alarmism and all, you are working in a multilateral environment, and you know, energy financing is not just what we could do locally, right? I think the energy financing has to come from all big international institutions, and almost all international energy funding is now driven by ESG goals. I mean, there was no substantial investment in oil and energy that has happened even in the last decade. I think has been the decadal low in
oil and gas investments across the world, actually. So, you know, with this level of massive decline in oil and gas investments, obviously, and with energy financing almost ESG driven, I think it's not just, you know, environment, but basic economics for India also to embrace renewable energy push. So I think that's the way the levers are also being used. So, you know, we like it or not, we need to look at renewables seriously.
Right. All right, moving on. The big news from last week was also that the WHO has finally approved Covaxin under the emergency use listing status. Until Wednesday, Covaxin was not WHO approved vaccine, and recipients with plans to travel abroad were either asked to quarantine on arrival, produce a negative RT-PCR test, or get vaccinated. The United States has given a green light to travelers vaccinated with Bharat Biotech's Covaxin to enter the country. The revised rules will come into effect from November 8th, when the US is all set to open its borders to vaccinated foreign travelers. Prasanna, this was a pretty important piece of news, right, from last week.
See, I think it was delayed, but good news, you know. See, let's be very honest that a lot of these WHO approvals per se is as much about science and procedures as well as it is about geopolitics and political power and all that stuff. You know, I don't think so. Some of these Chinese vaccines are put through this rigorous level of check. So to that extent, very good in terms of the efficacy, which, and I think large part of Covaxin's trials coincided with the second wave as well. You know, like, see, some of the other WHO approved vaccines were, probably approved as early as January, February. But Covaxin was, it was actually the peak testing, the trial happened during the second wave. So with the 78% efficacy, I think it's a triumph of Indian science, especially the way public private partnership here happened. Though we kind of tend to criticize government bureaucracy and all, ICMR's role in this has been pretty critical, and you know, the Department of Biosciences especially also played a very critical role. So I think it's a stellar example of public-private partnership. And from a implication perspective, what does the WHO approval do? If you really look at it, already 13 crore Covaxins have been administered in India. But two crucial things happen, I think, because of this approval for which it is very critical. One, obviously, the mobility of the Indians. You know, like a lot of Indians were administered two doses of Covaxin, and now that it's a WHO approved, and mobility for Indians is a very critical, especially for, you know, educated Indians who tend to be very mobile in terms of they constitute a large part of the globally mobile workforce as well. So it becomes very critical. And even for, you know, the population that goes to the Middle East, all kinds of labor mobility from India is going to help. Two, I think, if you really look at the vaccination, right, it's been like extremely polarizing in terms of the number. You know, there is the developed nations, which is already talking about their booster doses. And then you have African nations where some of the numbers are so abysmal. And so many countries where, you know, there is probably 10%, 15% vaccination rates. So obviously there's a huge potential for commercial opportunities also through, you know, all these multilateral vaccine agencies which are operating, right? The COVAX, Gavi, all that, which have committed certain levels of vaccines for all these countries. So Covaxin can potentially have a huge play in all of these markets, you know, since it's got a WHO approval. Hopefully, you know, but as I said, you know, this is just not about science or the efficacy of the vaccine. It is also a function of the geopolitical power of a particular country, you know, like, so you have to out to compete with all these big pharmas of the world, which
are helped largely by their the affluent countries backing them through various structural arrangements that are already in place. So I think, but still I would think that COVAXIN has a good play. And if you're talking about booster doses, India is still not started as less than 18 vaccination, right? Which is like 40% of India's population, almost 40% of India's population. It's like almost 45 to 50 crore people under the age of 18. So that's another huge market that COVAXIN can trap. I think the one limitation for COVAXIN has been the scalability and production challenges. I think they have tied up with 4-5 production units, and they have their own additional production capability, which began to churn out output in Karnataka as well. So there is this what is called as a production hell phase for all vaccines, like 2-3 months getting the vaccine chemistry right in a commercial scale and doing that scale operation, I think becomes a huge challenge for all. I think Moderna went through, even AstraZeneca went through. COVAXIN has been a longer period for them to stabilize this production challenges. So hopefully, I think based on what the company has said, I think they've come through that. And if they can really scale up, I think this they have a wider market to trigger to, especially since it's produced in India, there's a cost aspect to it, which will make it very appealing. So overall, excellent news for COVAXIN. And I think we've really, really punched way, way above our, especially on vaccine. If you really look at the previous vaccine records of India from the time it was globally administered, and probably when the rest of the world has already administered it, we've not even started administering vaccines. That used to be the situation. From there to probably vaccinating 70% of the adult population once, and not only that, completely indigenously developing and deploying a vaccine in the country. I think it's a huge, huge leap for the Indian scientific establishment, and a big template where, rapid public-private partnership can come together and create serious value. So hopefully, we've not had many such success stories. So I think this provides some replicable model moving forward. Actually, big boost for Indian pharma, I would say.
Yeah. Kudos to Bharat Biotech as well.
Yeah.
All right. Going on. 23 states have cut VAT on petrol and diesel after the center lowered excise duty on auto fuels. According to an official statement, states that reduced fuel prices the most were Karnataka, followed by Puducherry and Mizoram. On Wednesday evening, the center had announced a reduction in excise duty on petrol by Rs. 5 a litre and diesel by Rs. 10 a litre. The move came into effect from Thursday morning, bringing down the retail price of petrol in the national capital to Rs. 103.97 a litre and diesel to Rs. 86.67 a litre. Nirav, this was kind of expected, right?
So, okay, if you go back, what India had done was, India was earlier, if you go back to 2013, where India was part of the Fragile Five and Taper Tantrum, India was subsidizing fuel very heavily. And after that, they slowly started increasing the excise duty gradually all the way in 2014. Then the new administration came in. When global oil prices fell, what they did is they kept the retail price is same, but they kept inching up the duties. That is was a big source of tax revenue. Correct. That is why petrol prices and diesel prices are not part of the GST as well. There the excise and VAT regime remains. And last year in 2020, when the oil prices again fell off massively, India, what they did was just raise the taxes. That time the volume of sales was also very low, so tax collection was still low. And what they've done is whenever prices fall globally, they raise the taxes and keep the retail price similar. So consumers don't really feel anything. And then when prices rise, the higher taxes and higher tax collection went on. So that was because economic activity was slower. There was no other easy source of tax revenue. Now this has flipped. you are seeing GST collection of 1.3 lakh crores. You're crossing over a lakh crores every month. So now that other tax collection is robust, Indian government's borrowing is also on track. Fiscal deficit is on track. So then they've done this thing of reducing petrol and diesel prices. There's a second effect as well, that this helps kind of reduce consumer inflation. So then RBI also probably may not need to hike rates so soon. So this is another positive. The third thing I think is very psychological. See, what happens is people give too much weightage to fuel prices and vegetable prices psychologically on the level of inflation that they are facing. See, what happens is you buy vegetables on a daily basis and you buy fuel probably on a weekly basis, if not. So any change at the petrol pump, you kind of feel, oh my God, prices are going up, or, oh wow, prices are going down. And there's a bigger psychological effect.
Correct.
If you really see the impact of these fuel price cuts probably is 0.2% on the consumer price inflation. That is like 0.1, 0.15% direct. And because diesel is used for transportation of all goods, the indirect aspect. So whether prices move up or down 5% or 5.2% really shouldn't change consumer behavior much, but this has a psychological effect. So it's a very nice, positive, festive feeling. A lot of consumers feel, oh wow, they save some money and they go out and spend it on some other things. So maybe gives boost to other consumer spending as well. So I think it's a very good move. I think this is also taking another political dimension, where the BJP rule states have kind of cut their state VAT as well, because excise is central tax, VAT is the state tax, and giving like a boost to consumers, whereas other states haven't. I think it's a good thing that they've reduced these taxes, but I don't want or expect them to reduce them a lot more. We do need to have some sort of tax collection. Otherwise, either the government has to borrow more or raise other taxes, like raise GST or raise income tax, right? So there has to be a balance. Fuel tax did their share of heavy lifting earlier. Hopefully the economy grows enough and other tax collections pick up. So that's what it is.
Yeah. Prasanna, like, quick comments?
I think, yeah, Neera was summed it up very perfectly. See, there is definitely a certain inelastic fuel-related demand, okay? Like which essentially it was a willy strategy by the government to capture that by taxing that inelastic part of the energy demand. And and let's be very honest that during COVID times, you know, not many sources of revenue for the government, unless you get into the kind of printing and borrowing that probably affluent Western countries can afford, and India can't do it without facing serious consequences. So I think fuel was certainly milked by both central and state government to address revenue requirements. There's no running away from stating that. But right now, with other revenue sources stabilizing or even picking up, like GST and all, I think government did well probably to give what was the best possible relief that they could give, which is the kind of prices that they've given. And the other thing is that actually when the prices increase, not many people know that since states do ad valorem, I think whenever the price increases, the revenues for the states go up more than for the center, because center is a fixed central excise, okay? While state is an ad valorem VAT actually. So the though the states would be seen as complaining about the high prices, they kind of benefit immensely because of the VAT kind of structure. And as usual, you know, from a political perspective, I think, the petrol over the years, and even BJP has played a role in it, is almost become like the 100 rupees is a kind of a psychological barrier for the prices, and anything beyond that, there is a sense of despondency in the country. Even BJP used to do that, now Congress does it. So, you know, this entire energy pricing is politicized and linked to the state of well-being of the nation to that extent that, you know, like it becomes a huge political issue. So I think the government actually went
know, I mean, they could have probably done it 2 months earlier, but I think like they kind of really took it to the extreme. And probably once they kind of realized that the coffers are a much more comfortable position and they have some room for fiscal, you know, relief to be provided, I think they have done it. And I think from a overall political perspective, it is a neutral thing, you know, like I think like very high petrol prices certainly have electoral consequences, but you know, price reduction or even anything else is neutral for the government, you know. So it's not like when people say it's a politically motivated cut, I don't really understand what it means. I mean, all decisions are politically motivated or election oriented, you know. I mean, and especially in a country like India, I mean, you can't link a reduction to a by-election cycle, you know. I mean, you have elections every 6 months in the country, so it's all not always determined by elections. And of course, politicians do respond to cues from elections. That's also a fact. So overall, I think they used oil and oil revenues to, it was milked as much as possible to the extent that politics permitted it. And now, since they have an opportunity, they've kind of cut it actually. So that's my sense.
Right. All right. So that's a wrap from us. And before we leave, a couple of episodes that we're going to put out next week. We had a fascinating discussion with Ms. Aruna Sharma. She's a former IAS officer, has served for about 3+ decades and has written a book on, you know, how elected officials can better manage their constituencies. And it's a really fascinating. I mean, I was just saying this to Nirav that she is so execution focused and has gotten her hands dirty on so many different axes, right? Whether it's infrastructure, whether it's IT or and so on. That you know, she's so comprehensive in her answers, and this was a fairly long discussion as well, 90 minutes plus. So do definitely check it out. Also, I mean, in the Wellina's talk series, we had of course the one and only Mr. Vikram Sood appearing on the podcast. So this is again a very fascinating discussion on geopolitics and India intelligence and so on. And of course, I mean, with everything that's happened over the last few months, it's a little more important right now. So yeah, do check out these episodes and let us know what you think. This was a fantastic discussion. Nirav and Prasanna, thank you so much for joining us again, and thank you all for joining. Until next week, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.